Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Barry Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to playwright Rosemary Zebart about a new play, a set of plays, actually, by her that is opening up this weekend. And also some of the actors and directors of these short plays are going to be here as well. I'd like now to welcome Antonio Lopez. He's a Santa Fe person gone away and come back. We're delighted to have him back. He has a photo exhibition of photographs called Media Ruins, which is at the Cruz Gallery at 616 Canyon Road, and it opens this Friday, the 18th of August, and runs through, the 18th of July, and runs through the 3rd of August. There's a reception this Friday from 5 to 7:30. And he is also the author of a new book called Mediacology, A Multicultural Approach to Media Literacy in the 21st Century. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here with you.
It's great to have you back. Let's talk first about the exhibition of photographs. These are photographs, you call them, it's so interesting that you're doing media literacy, and then these are photographs of what you call media ruins. What does that mean?
Well, most of these photos I took in Rome, and I'm very interested in the behavior of the street as an organic media space. And one of the things that got me interested in media literacy was I was disgruntled with corporate media and wanted more, see more of what we call the public sphere, you know, the human, organic types of communication that I've always loved since I've been a punk rocker, you know, when I was 15 years old. And so in the streets, I see this very alive, organic, emergent behavior that's not directed by any person, and it's a true dialogue between advertisers, artists, graffiti writers, activists, and I love to see these different layers. So the work that I do in my photographic work is just to document that, and often these things are only last for 12 hours. You know, anytime I see something, I jump off the bus and photograph it, because if I come back, it's usually gone. And I think there's something interesting about that too.
Now, why do these things last such a short time?
Because it's always evolving and always changing. And I think that's a great metaphor for human life.
For example, what are we talking about? Somebody writing on an advertising poster, or putting graffiti on an advertising poster, and then the advertiser comes along and takes it down?
There's a constant war. It's a war of attention. And for example, you may have heard there was a big national election in Italy recently. And literally, you would see there would be a wall, and you'd see two guys, one putting up the poster for the left, and right behind them was a car with guys from the right putting up posters right on top of it, dripping with the cornstarch, whatever, the glue that they use. And it was changing every hour towards the last minute, because Rome, where I live, is a very pedestrian culture. People walk in the streets, and New York is very similar that way, where you have a lot of organic behavior happening in the streets. So that's where people are trying to get each other's attention, and it's also the most accessible place to anybody, whether you're a propagandist or just an artist. It's a free canvas. You don't need to buy access to a website or a gallery. It's right there.
One of the things, I lived in Italy for a short time when I was in college, but that I loved about it was that the rules of life are not as strictly enforced there as they are here. So there's a kind of feeling of anarchy in the air at all times, where people just do whatever they want to.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Italy, for me, Rome in particular, is kind of a mix between Paris and Mexico City. So Mexico City is one of my favorite cities in the world, and it has this aspect of total chaos, yet there's somehow this emergent order, which is, again, something that interests me about the street art. Like, how do cities evolve? How do people collectively build things without anyone individually doing that? And that theme runs throughout my book too, because the new social networks and the new types of media that are emerging are very similar, and people are starting to see similar patterns with the way that nature ecosystems operate. With these, they require open networks. in order to function. And so the street is an open network of communication, and so is a computer network. I mean, assuming
it's,
that
I mean, it's complexity theory.
Yeah, it's complex, exactly. And the people in Santa Fe who go to the lectures at the Santa Fe Institute.
Or listen to this show.
Or listen to the show, probably very familiar with these ideas. And I like to see it in action.
We're talking to Antonio Lopez. So these are that's what the photographs are about. Let's talk about the book, Mediacology, A Multicultural Approach to Media Literacy in the 21st Century. First of all, what do you mean by media literacy?
Okay, well, media literacy has always been a problematic term because literacy is a term specific to writing and to reading books. And multimedia really is completely different. So there's a tension between approaching the world from like the way that a book is structured. A book has a certain kind of architecture, so does writing. And new multimedia that most people are using has a completely different architecture.
So now, I thought media literacy was about, for example, analyzing the structure of TV and commercials and to try to figure out how they're attempting to warp your mind.
Well, yes. The most generic definition of media literacy is to take a media sample, analyze it, decode it, and be able to communicate your findings as a response. But in a way, that's the same model that we have when we study a book. We read a book in school and then write a paper about it. But media is more social. It's a little bit different. It involves, like, for example, if you do a media production, it's going to involve a crew of people. And that would be different than the solo act of writing a paper about a book. And so I was interested in this tension between this sort of book literacy practice that media literacy people use, because they are studying media, but they're sort of looking at media as if it were some kind of a book, when really it behaves completely differently.
So what are the differences that you're talking about and the tension between the two different ways of looking at media literacy?
Well, let me give a practical example, because sometimes it can sound a little too theoretical and doesn't make any sense.
Right.
A traditional media literacy approach would be, let's take an advertisement from a magazine, and we take it out of context, okay? So here's a tobacco ad, and it's completely removed from where it came from. And we decode it with maybe a group of students will decode it and then talk to the rest of the group. Okay, what is this ad? What is the text? What is the subtext? This is very classical media literacy.
And you find out things like the text is smoke this cigarette, and the subtext is if you smoke this cigarette, you will have friends and be popular and look very handsome.
Right, exactly. And so that works to a point. So yes, that is a good technique, and everyone should learn this technique in school if they don't already. Unfortunately, it's not something that's part of the standard curriculum. But in New Mexico is a very unique place. New Mexico is actually one of the national leaders in media literacy. But here's where you come up against a problem. This kind of approach doesn't actually look at the context of the person who's viewing the media, because every time we see something, we bring our own values and our own experience to it. And so when we see this tobacco ad, it's not brainwashing me. These codes don't go into my mind and tell me to think a certain way. It's working with a lot of other mechanisms that are based on my own personal experience. So one of the things that I noticed when I was working a lot with Native Americans is that if you come in and say, okay, let's deconstruct the tobacco ad because tobacco's evil, the Native American group says, wait a second, tobacco's a sacred plant. How can you say that this is an evil product? So you have to qualify it, and you have to put it into the context and say, the history of tobacco is that it got colonized, and that what you're seeing is a colonized expression of tobacco, but it's not we're not here to demonize tobacco, because I see that has happened over and over, and people in tribal schools, they don't invite the media literacy people back because they were insensitive to the culture. And so that got me thinking, like, well, that's not just true with tobacco ads, it's true with everything. And I think that a more ecological approach is in the case, and I use the term media permaculture, because permaculture works with the landscape. You know, what is the parameters of your land or your garden? How much rain do you get? You know, that to me is an important aspect of what does the meaning of the ad actually mean. It's not just, there's not some kind of objective generic meaning coded into the ad. There's my interaction with it as well.
So leaving aside the tobacco being sacred example, how, like, contextualized an ad like the one you're talking about in the context of a magazine, like, let's say, you know, the New Yorker or Rolling Stone or whatever, and you being a college-educated man from Santa Fe living in Rome looking, I mean, how does bringing all that other stuff into it affect the way you think about media literacy?
Well, maybe what I should just go back to when I was a teenager, because I think that the way that media is talked about, according to the sort of standard media paradigm, a media literacy education paradigm, I should be a totally brainwashed person, because I grew up as a kid, Generation X, watching 4 or 5 hours of television every day. I'm a completely mediated person.
Mediated.
Mediated, yes. Yet, I somehow have a critical relationship with that material. Why did that happen? I wasn't taught media literacy in school, but my parents appreciated art. I had a good education. I went to alternative schools. I was introduced to different cultures. I grew up in a multicultural environment. And all these things enabled me to have a different relationship. And I think the problem with a lot of people that write about the evil effects of media is that they sort of imagine in their minds a typical person who's totally brainwashed and has no opinions of their own. And I wanted to move away from that. There's a whole school of media theory called critical theory that came out of Marxism that sort of generically thinks about people as all completely being like Adorno, who's the most famous of this critical theory school, will write articles saying, and the person who buys the opera ticket doesn't appreciate the music because he's more interested in the fetish of the ticket and of the... And he doesn't know this person. You know,
and he's also, just by definition, excluding himself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay, so how come you are Mr. Smart Guy?
Yeah, and everybody else is below you.
Yeah, exactly. It's very elitist. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was one of the things I feel like I'm arguing against, is the elitism of media activism and media literacy that I find pervasive. Even though it pays lip service to populism and it pays lip service to democracy, even it pays lip service to participation, I find that more often than not, there's an agenda that this person has to walk away from this workshop with a specific understanding that they're being, you know, mind-screwed by the corporations.
Right.
And I think that's not fair to the student.
We're talking to Antonio Lopez. The book is called Mediacology. It is also, I think, pretty verifiably true that there are a lot of people in this country of average intelligence with jobs that don't require a whole lot of analytical skills who completely buy the propaganda that they are fed on the media, whether it be Fox News. I mean, I have a blood relative who voted for George Bush the second time purely on the basis of the Swift boat video.
Yes, well, there's no doubt that propaganda works. Otherwise, people wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't use it. So people have to be creatively engaged in a way that they understand how propaganda works. And propaganda works because it works psychologically. It appeals to people's fears or biases. But I have a theory. I can't prove this. But after the last election, I remember looking at, okay, who voted for who? The red and the blue, you know, the so-called red and blue states. But I looked at a map of county by county voting. And what I noticed was that the blue blocks were on waterways, so on rivers, or on coasts, on lakes. And to me, that indicated that these were places of trade, of interaction, of multicultural relationships. And the places that were more like the so-called red blocks were inland, you know, I like to even say gated communities of the mines, you know, like that.
More isolated.
And these are going to be areas that are less exposed to alternative viewpoints. I mean, even Washington, D.C., if you go there, is like one of these sort of gated communities of the mind, because it's a certain demographic of wealth and privilege and insider relationships that exclude a whole reality that's outside of that bubble. So one of the anecdotes for me is, yes, media literacy, definitely. Let's bring that in. But let's also bring in some kind of multicultural perspective, or let's start engaging in other relationships, other communities, and learn more about how other people think. And one of the ways to do that is through media, is to have an exchange and a relationship with people telling stories about their lives through the media tools that are available to them.
Now, when you talk about different kinds of media, that you keep coming back to life on the street and real person-to-person contact, as opposed to, for example, what we're engaging in now, which is the two of us talking remotely from a table and then, you know, hundreds or thousands of people out there listening who can't talk back.
Well,
they can write me an email.
Well, see, this is the old paradigm of media, which is industrial media coming out of the Industrial Revolution, where you have a few media companies who, based on mutual business interests, basically have a very similar point of view, and they broadcast the knowledge that people consume, and the only real feedback is maybe through letters to the editor, or if you're an advertiser, you can, you know, protest saying you're going to withdraw your ad. But that was the only real feedback mechanism. But now the environment is much different. We're in a many-to-many media sharing environment. So, for example, this radio show between you and me will be broadcast at a certain specific time, but also it's going to be available in archives through searchable. Anyone can search it. I have a blog. I'm going to say...
You're going to link to it.
Yeah, link. Here's the show. Other people read my blog. Maybe they'll link to it. And so... And this is all through my own personal social network. And maybe you have your own social network that's connected to your show. And they will share if they hear an idea that's really cool. They're going to say, oh, yeah, let's pass this along. So now we have, there's a lot more horizontal distribution of information now, which is radically transforming the whole media communication system. So
how much of an effect do you think that has? I mean, one of the things that I like to do, this is... I probably shouldn't even reveal this, but I like to read the Salon.com advice column. The advice actually given by the columnist is often dreadful, but usually dozens or hundreds of people write in their opinion about it, and usually one of them has a very good piece of advice. And so there's this, as you say, very much of a community thing going on. I wonder how much of an effect that, I mean, how much of a real back and forth there is where hard news is concerned, where real news stories are concerned of that kind.
Well, I think that you always are going to need hard news, investigative journalism, which is very expensive. It requires a lot of resources. The newspaper...
And is somewhat rare these days.
Yes, and as everyone probably knows, the newspaper paradigm is falling apart because the traditional revenue streams for newspapers such as classifieds are going to Craigslist, personals are going to social network sites... And the advertisers need audiences, and readership is getting smaller because they're going to the web. But I think there's always going to be a space for hard news. I mean, there's going to be... The New York Times may not exist as a newspaper in the future, but it will exist as a website. But what's more exciting to me is citizen journalism and this idea of community filtering, where there's a lot of... in Korea, South Korea, there's an amazing... citizen journalist website where the people in the community actually write all the news stories, and they actually change the results of a recent presidential election, and they have that much of a powerful influence. And through community filtering, the idea that people will sort of weed out the bad stuff through voting or through, you know, mutual communication like we do in our own face-to-face communication, like in Wikipedia, you have sort of all these anonymous people constantly reading and adding and subtracting to shape something to make it more perfect. In some ways, that journalism is just as powerful because New York Times is not going to have anyone in Kenya really covering what's happening. But you have people on the street who are twittering, where's the riot, where's the police crackdown, who's going to jail, and it's being loaded up live on a website with a Google map.
And it's very hard to censor when there are so many different kinds of media and ways to upload and distribute
this. Yeah, exactly.
Even though it's not that there's no censorship. I mean,
China is a good example.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm not...
You can't get this show in China. You can't.
Oh, really?
You can't go to the podcast.
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to call this a utopian environment. You have a little bit of everything.
Well, and also, how do you, in citizen journalism, how do you filter what is reliable?
Well, this is one of the big issues. I just read a great book called True Enough by a Salon. Salon.com columnist. And True Enough is an interesting book because he looks at the Swift Boat campaign, which you mentioned, and he wanted to know why does this work? And he also talks about 911 conspiracies and all these sort of different phenomena that are out there. And what's the appeal? Why are people attracted to certain kinds of information? And he goes through a lot of psychological studies. And essentially the problem that we're in now is that you have to trust who your source is. That's what it comes down to. What kind of relationship?
Well, that's the question.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, we know that we can't always trust the New York Times. There's
right.
been enough media about that. But we don't know for sure whom we can trust, especially when it's a non-established venue.
And the environment does allow for a lot of disinformation, probably more so than in the more traditional media environment. But at the same time, you also have more checks against it. And so rumors definitely come up very quickly, but then you have people investigating on their own time the truth of a particular situation. And again, it's problematic, but I guess this goes back to even in your own neighborhood, who do you trust? You know, it's based on someone, you've had experiences with people, and did that person screw you over, or did that person treat you properly?
So when you look at what's happening today and what the possibilities are for what you call a sustainable approach to media, what does sustainable media look like? I mean, you think of sustainable as a term that applies to agriculture and actual natural organic things.
Right. Well, there's two aspects to it. There's the sustainable side of just being able to continually to publish, to be able to exist as a business or as a publication. There's that piece of it. And the web is very sustainable because it's so cheap to publish and so cheap to be a media maker. That in itself is radically transforming the media system because it doesn't take much money to own a domain and to have a server and to use all the free software tools. Okay, so there's that aspect of it. Then there's the aspect of the sustainable minds. And I talk about my book, Designing for Pattern. Like, a lot of environmental sustainable projects frame themselves in the context of the industrial economy. So that, like, for example, Sierra Club, who does a lot of great work, but they also work in the context of, well, this is the way the system thinks, and we have to react to it. We have to have lobbyists, we have to advertise. And the other idea that is emerging is that, no, we have to design for pattern. What is the actual mental process of a sustainable system, which is has to be open? So the mind has to be open to different ideas. And so the media has to be open to linking and to networking. In fact, if you study the way that cells work, there's this idea of memes that's very popular. I'm against this idea of the meme because the meme means that a meme is an idea that is self-contained. You know, I can take it from my mind and implant it in your mind, and you implant it into a different person's mind. And this comes from the idea that cells take DNA and they transport, and the DNA, and the idea somehow has a DNA. And I think that's an industrial kind of thinking, because industrial thinking is that ideas are things. And there's this conduit metaphor.
You're piping things from point A to point B.
Exactly. Do you get my idea? Like, it's something that I'm handing you, or, you know.
Right.
And the way that cells work is that cells are actually networks of enzymes, and it works with other networks, and the network has to be open in a certain way so it can be adaptable. So sustainable media needs to operate in the same way, that it needs to be open, adaptable, flexible, that incorporates different voices, that filters different voices, so certain kinds of emergent complexity theory can arise. And that is happening in the social network media.
You, at the beginning of the book, you use a metaphor of holistic medicine versus conventional, for example, cancer medicine. So in conventional cancer medicine, you cut out a tumor and then you put a lot of toxins in the body and hope the cancer dies. And in holistic medicine, like acupuncture, you strengthen the body so that it kills the cancer by itself.
Yeah.
Leaving aside that it's pretty hard to cure cancer with acupuncture, how does this metaphor work in terms of media, where you have this, you know, very powerful media empire of, you know, television and radio and so on? That, I mean, the internet is there, but it certainly has not by any means done away with the many hours of TV watching that people do.
Well, this is where you know, the audience for my book is actually media educators, people who work in schools. So I'd like to go back to like a practical situation to address your question. Okay, when I was a teenager, one of the most powerful experiences I had was the punk movement. And so I like to say I have a PhD in punk rock because I learned DIY. And one of the first experiences I had that kind of blew my mind, where I had an epiphany, I was
DIY.
Do it yourself. Yeah.
Okay.
Not the home building network on the web, but you know, making zines, making your own records, putting on your own shows, kind of like what they do at Warehouse 21. It's basically what they do.
Right.
I wrote a letter to the punk zine, and they published it. And I was like, wow, you know, my letter is in print. And it sounds silly. I was 14 years old. But it's like...
That's a big deal when you're 14 years
old. Yeah, it's like I existed, you know.
Especially pre-internet.
Yeah, this is pre-internet. We use Xerox machines and staplers and glue and scissors, that kind of stuff. And so I kept writing letters, and they kept publishing more letters. And I thought, well, this is stupid. I should just make my own magazine. So the kids and I in our neighborhood made our own publication. And through this process, we learned about distribution, we learned about advertising, we learned about business, but also about journalism and all these things. And so when I work with kids, if they don't have that perspective that they have the power to create their own media, then they're going to feel a bit invaded, like that they have no control. Like it's almost like the media is some kind of mystical, godlike experience. And I like to use that metaphor because going around Rome, the Renaissance is very similar. You have the church creating all this art, and it's sort of inaccessible. It's like this high thing, and these high ceilings that you cannot touch. And with the kids, if they know that they can create their own media, all of a sudden you're changing the relationship. You're demystifying. Just that very act of creation demystifies the relationship. And I think that is very, very important. So I'm a big fan of doing production, of doing either making music or video or art. I mean, really, we need more art. And the fact that No Child Left Behind is cutting out art and music in schools is ridiculous.
Well, in theory, if you had media production programs the way you had English and math classes, that would create something that would probably be a little threatening, which was a generation of savvy, media-savvy young people who knew. I mean, this is one thing I actually think about sometimes when watching television. Which TV ads actually have an effect on me?
Uh-huh.
You know, making me want to buy something. And the only one I've been able to determine is pizza.
Yeah.
When I see those strings of melted pizza departing from the other string. But other than that, there's nothing. Because I've studied this so much. And if you had a whole generation of young people, it would be a new world.
Well, and the truth is, we don't know if advertising works, in all honesty. I mean, the advertisers...
The pizza advertising works. Although it might not be for the same pizza place.
But they have very little way of confirming whether or not an ad actually makes a sale. The way that ads do work is that they construct an ideological system of consumption. So it works in a more distributed way. But advertisers are actually completely freaked out. Because teenagers, for one, are completely skeptical. They know they're being
having the wool pulled over their eyes.
Yeah, they know they're being manipulated. You could tell any teenager that and they'd laugh. Yeah, of course, you know, they're very savvy. And they don't like to be sold anything anymore. So it's all about the soft sell. That's the new paradigm. But I want to go back to something what you're saying about threatening, because, you know, before the printing press, writing was actually considered to be a very sacred elite activity. And they did not want it to go out to the general public. Only very, very few people were taught how to read and write. And in fact, even in the monasteries, which is where most literacy was communicated, the Bibles were actually chained down because they didn't want you to take it and read it by yourself. They wanted to make sure someone was there to monitor that what you were reading was being read properly. And when books came out, or the printing press, as we know, created the whole Protestant Revolution. And new media is always a threat to the power structure, because the power structure, I think there's always this state of instability, and then it sort of gels, and the power structure learns how to harness the existing tools. I mean, writing was necessary to document trade, and the earliest examples of writing are all about documenting who owes people what based on, you know, how many sheep or jars of oil are being shipped from here to there. And also to communicate to the distant empire post, you know, their orders. So there's always been a relationship between media and control. And anytime something comes new, then there's a threat. So yes, absolutely, new media production is a threat. That's why you don't see it as part of the standard education model, because I believe public education is designed to train people how to work in the system, not to challenge the system.
So what are you doing now in terms of teaching media or encouraging others to think of media literacy in a new way?
Well, I wrote the book, which was my salvo across the, you know, I'm just waiting to see the reviews to come in. It's only been out for a month, to create a dialogue. I haven't done so much in classroom work in a while, simply because of the time it takes to write and do research. And so I'm kind of in a mode right now of thinking and writing about process and to inspire people. And I'm also doing my own art, such as the photos that are going to be at the Cruise Gallery on Friday, because I have to be able to feed my soul, so to speak, through creative expression. And I'm sort of looking for the right situation to plug into, because I think one of the reasons I had to write this book was there was no place for me, really, because the standard media literacy movement, I was working within it, but I was also feeling a little bit like an outsider. And the ecology movement, because I'm a media guy, I'm also an outsider, because a lot of ecologists are very hostile towards technology and consider media to be the enemy.
Right.
And I actually had a conversation with a very famous anti-media ecologist about bringing media literacy into ecological education. He says, I think media literacy is important, but I'm against it. And I said, well, why? He said, because it makes media interesting, and I don't want people to be interested in media. And it's true.
That's an uphill battle. I mean, people are going to be interested, so you might as well embrace it.
And there's, you know, certain philosophies and certain types of martial arts where you take the strongest thing and try to leverage that in your favor, you know, like the weight of the enemy,
Aikido.
Duck and let them fall, like Aikido, exactly. I talk about media Aikido in my book.
Right. Well, I think there's a lot of very interesting things in this book, and I definitely recommend it. Are you making this book available to people here at your exhibition?
Yeah, I'll have it available. I'll have it with me at the exhibition. Right now, it's available on Amazon. Also, if you go to my website, which is I'm going to spell it out because it sounds funny. MediaCology.com. It's my blog.
MediaCology.com.
MediaCology.com. There's a link to buy it on Amazon. I blog. Any kind of feedback that's going to come out concerning the book will be there. And I also expand my ideas and update my ideas. So,
in the very way that you're talking about.
Yes, because I want it to be organic. I mean, I talk about the contradiction of a book being sort of like a remnant of industrial technology. You know, a thing, I have to put my knowledge in a book, therefore it exists. Now I'm a legitimate person. I'm a published author. Now I can go out and, you know, have a real legitimate life.
Go do a speaking tour.
Yeah, I could do, I'm a real person. In fact, I'm a professor at a university, and I don't have a PhD, but the fact that I wrote a book makes it... so I can work. So this is sort of like to legitimate a little bit also my thoughts, you know, so
there's a lot of ironies basically in what you're doing.
It's hugely ironic, most definitely. And I don't think the book is the most ideal medium, but I love books. You know, when I moved to Italy, I paid a couple $1,000s to get my library on an ocean container. Probably not good for global warming, but you know, I always like to joke, if my books could pay rent, you know, I would be a rich man.
Antonio Lopez is the author of Media Ecology, A Multicultural Approach to Media Literacy in the 21st Century, and he is going to be at the Cruise. Where's the little card for the exhibition, which is at the Cruise Gallery. His photographs, the exhibition is called Media Ruins, and it's a series of photographs that will be at the Cruise Gallery at 616 Canyon Road from July 18th to August 3rd, and on Friday, July 18th, there's a reception from 5 to 7. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It was a pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR.
The Santa Fe Art Institute is honored to present photo documentarians Armando Espinosa and Craig Johnson. On Monday, July 21st at 6 p.m. in Tipton Hall, Espinosa and Johnson will speak about their Metamorphosis documentation project. And July 22nd through the 25th, they'll give a workshop on the challenges of doing field work in new or culturally different locations. For more information, call 424-5050 or visit sfai.org.
I'd like now to welcome Rosemary Zebart. She's a playwright whose series of plays, Babe Inc., opens this weekend at El Museo Cultural. And we're also joined by Jeannie Michaela and Stephanie Burrows, actor and director in these plays. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Now, these are four short plays and one mid-length play. Were they conceived together?
Not at all. I mean, they were, I've been writing on these plays probably for 10 or 12 years. Some of them were inspired by a course on comedy writing that I took about 8 years ago at UNM with Digby Wolfe, who was a writer for Laugh-In. And, you know, I don't know where my inspiration comes from, but basically there's stuff that's just been sitting in my file cabinet, except for Babe Inc., which has gone out and been in a number of different festivals in London, and it's going to be in New York next week and stuff like that. So I thought if it's in New York, it should be here. So that's how this all came about.
So as far as I can tell, they all deal with sexual politics and dramas of various kinds.
Great description.
From a women's point of view.
Yeah, right. That's absolutely true, although, like I said, they were inspired at all different stages, so they reflect different points of view, for sure.
One of the questions that comes up is, what is liberation?
Right. Well, that was just kind of an off-the-cuff, that was the most recent one that I've done. I call it A Zoo Story, it's not The Story by Pinter. Or is it Albie? I always get that mixed up. But at any rate, yeah, right. I don't know. That's a more recent work, and it kind of has to do with the relationship between that particular couple and whether they're going to engage with one another or whether they're not going to engage with another. It's kind of existential, I would say, in a very brief 6-page script.
And it uses the setup, which is kind of like almost a sitcom cliche of the man reading his newspaper and not wanting to talk to the wife and the wife babbling on and on.
Exactly. Well, you have to, for humor, you have to use the conventions that exist because people are kind of used to that. And the challenge is to make it deeper, to use those conventions, but at the same time have a real point that you're trying to get across.
Now, the play that Stephanie Burrows directed and that Jeannie Michaela is in, Limbido, also deals with liberation in another way. And it's a great piece with these two. The other actor isn't here, but you are playing against, you're a young woman playing against an older woman. The chemistry is fabulous between you. She is dealing with her life, and you are her libido, which comes in to haunt her.
Yes, in fact, Carmela plays a woman who is going through menopause, and I play libido personified. And speaking of liberation, there are a number of wonderful remarks on what liberation truly is in our piece.
Exactly. So how did you get, there are all different directors for all of these pieces. How did you get involved in the directing part, Stephanie?
Rosemary called and asked me. And she and I have worked together off and on for some time, either with scripts or other theater processes, and she asked me to direct this one, and I said yes, and it was already cast, and I was thrilled with the two actresses.
Really? She was just stuck with us and is being polite. No kidding. We were delighted to have her join us.
Well, thank you. Both Jeannie and Carmela bring lots of experience and talent with them, and I knew what I wanted to do with this. Essentially, it was a conversation. And I thought, okay, how do we enliven this so that it's interesting? Because it had to be more than sitting in two chairs. Well, so nobody's sitting in any chairs. And they bring this wonderful physicality to it. And I feel as though we truly worked as an ensemble, the three of us, to bring a huge amount of spontaneity and playfulness to it and physicality, so that they're just, I'm thrilled with what they're doing.
Well, and the libido character is this very lithe, almost dancer who is working against, with and against the will of this older woman who kind of wants her libido and kind of doesn't.
I must say, this has been one of the most enjoyable rehearsal processes I've ever been through. We just investigated what it was like, to go through different phases of life, what it was like to go through menopause, what is libido? What is libido as a sexual principle? What is libido as a creative principle? And what is our relationship as women and in our society to libido and the power of libido? And what are the ways that we invite it and the ways that we try to hold it off?
And I know I was watching the rehearsal last night and I was thinking, this is a lot of stuff that everybody thinks about but nobody talks about.
Exactly.
Yep. Yep.
Well, it's been really fun for me to see my words manifested, because they took libido. I wrote that probably 8 years ago at least, and what they've done with it is so interesting and exciting and different than I could possibly have imagined. And that is really the fun process of working in theater, of all the different medias, because I've worked as a journalist, and I've worked in writing children's books, and I've worked in a lot of different media. But to see how people interpret your words, first, the directors have such a different point of view than my point of view. They see so many different levels of meaning. And that's always fascinating to me. And then the way the actors carry it forth is, again, totally different than I might have anticipated when I'm sitting behind my computer typing out these words.
Well, as a playwright who's made the decision not to be the director, you have to do quite a bit of letting go, I would think.
It's been a big challenge for me, because if I had been the director, I would have just said, this is how it's supposed to sound. And that's not really directing. Directing is really finding the emotions where they are in the actors, as opposed to just dictating what they should be.
Stephanie, what's your own background as a director?
As a director? Oh,
it's and actor?
I've been acting since I was in high school. And it's been actually quite a while since I've done any directing. I remember directing some Shaw at the community theater 20 years ago, something like that. But I now teach acting at the Santa Fe Community College and up at Northern New Mexico. And I publish an e-zine weekly called The Theater Salon, which is for the theater community. And the real joy for me, particularly in this situation with these actresses as a director, is how much they brought to it. Their willingness, their creativity, their artistry and skill, so that I'm not working in a void hoping that somebody can respond to what I'm saying, but in fact I'm able to respond to what they're doing, and then they respond to what I say, and the circle of energy and creativity just kept moving and moving.
Jeannie, tell us about your own background. You're fairly new to Santa Fe.
I actually lived here when I was 7 and 8 years old, and I've been back now for 2.5 years. I've been a professional actress my whole life. I started working on Broadway when I was 15, and then have done a lot of television and film work, and continue to do so here. And
what brought you here? New Mexico's burgeoning film industry?
You know, I still came in the intervening years, usually for Christmas, to visit, and picked up a local agent and was finally able to do some work here, and was just delighted to be able to come back.
Rosemary Zebart, let's talk about the play for a couple of minutes, which is the title of the whole evening, but the play itself, which is the one slightly longer play, is called Babe Inc., which is some kind of futuristic time in which we're not exactly sure where all the women have gone, but it's kind of like a Stepford Wives scenario where a lot of the women are actually robots.
Well, it takes place at a robotic dating service where men can go and custom order robotic companions, and they can get exactly what they want. And in the course of this particular play, a real woman, ends up substituting for a robotic woman to go with a man to his mother's funeral. And the key question is, what are the differences, you know, if men do choose to have robotic mates, which they may well in the future. After, long after, like 5 years after I wrote this play, there was a book about sex and robots, and apparently it is anticipated that that is a direction men are going to go in.
but I can't imagine.
Whatever.
But this goes into what are the differences between real women and robotic women in a humorous way, and why a man might choose to have a robotic companion, but in my opinion, most women would rather have a human man than a robotic mate.
And we will not give away any more about that particular play because right. It's very amusing. And I have to say that the woman who plays the robot woman does a terrifyingly good job.
Jodie Haggerty. Yeah, she's awesome. I was totally, in fact, all of my actors. I have a wonderful group of actors and directors, and I'm just thrilled about that. It is at El Museo Cultural who are bend over backwards to make everything possible, even though it's very challenging for them to do so because they've got so many things that they've stacked up. But I'm very, very excited about what it's going to look like this weekend.
And it opens on Friday at El Museo Cultural at 8 o'clock, Friday and Saturday, and then on Sunday at 2 in the afternoon, and that's on Paseo de Peralta right here in Santa Fe. Tell us just a little, we've got just about a minute and a half left, about your own playwriting career.
I have been a journalist for a few decades, and then gradually, I guess over the last 10 years, switched to writing stories and writing plays and writing screenplays, and I'm much more comfortable doing that actually at this point than being a journalist, although I still do that a little. And I have had some success. One of my plays was a semi-finalist at the Eugene O'Neill, and another play for young people was received an honor this year. I've only in the last 2 years started to send out my work. So
how did your journalism feed the playwriting?
Well, everything is storytelling. It's just the mode of storytelling that you choose, and the story itself dictates what kind of genre you'll choose. The story itself does. But I've always wanted to go to the very emotional heart of whatever the story is that I'm doing. And playwriting, you truly get that opportunity to do it really quick, and it demands it. That's what it's all about.
Rosemary Zebart is a playwright, Jeannie Michaela, actress, and Stephanie Burrows, director, and Babe Inc. opens this weekend. For more information, you can call 992-0591. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz includes some new CDs and the Artist of the Month, McCoy Tyner. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, and also the great storyteller Joe Hayes. So keep your dial tuned to KSFR 101.1 FM, ksfr.org. Hasta la vista. Ciao.